You are listening to an ADIS Journal podcast.
Hello, this is Professor Mario Cozzolino from the University of Milan, Renal Division at Santi Paolo Vaccaro in Milan, Department of Health Science. I'm a nephrologist, happy to welcome you in this podcast synopsis of the European Renal Best Practice and UK Kidney Association guidelines for the treatment of anemia and chronic kidney disease. Today we have two colleagues from UK, Dr. Socrates Stompos from the Renal and Transplant Unit at Queen Elizabeth University Hospital in Glasgow, UK, and Dr. Sumit Bhandari from the Yule University Teaching Hospital's National Health Service Trust, Yule, UK. So after this introduction, I would like to introduce the discussion of the anemia management in non-dialysis-dependent and dialysis-dependent CKD patients and the evolution that we had over the time during the last years. In fact, we know very well how important is the iron supplementation in our patients and how we learn how to use the erythropoiesis-stimulating agents during the years. But more recently, new drugs such as dihydroxyurea and its growth factor, probably like hydroxylase inhibitors that we are going to call the FPH drugs, came to our attention, and we can now use the treatment for our patients with CKD. So in 2024, the European Best Practice Board at the ERA, European Renal Association, published a clinical practice document specifically covering the use of the HIF in patients with CKD. Earlier this year, the UK Kidney Association updated its guidelines for treating anemia of CKD, including this treatment as a recommended additional therapy. So today, the purpose of this podcast is to discuss the implication of this publication for clinical practice, understand the role of its in treating anemia of CKD, and provide practical recommendations to help clinicians make treatment decisions. We know very well that the erythropoiesis-stimulating agents, ESAs, are the established standard of care. And minimal changes have been made to the ESA section of the UKK guidelines. The focus will primarily be only to the newer EFPHI drug class. So just start with the overview of the ESA versus EF. And what I would like to ask as my first question, Dr. Bhandari, is what are EFPHIs and how they different to the ESAs?
Many thanks, Mario. I think people might be aware that HIF-PHIs are a class of orally administered small molecules that really mimic the body's response to hypoxia, and that leads to a transient inhibition of HIF-prolyl hydroxylase domain enzymes. This results in the endogenous production of erythropoietin, as well as actually an improvement in the absorption of intestinal iron and its release from the iron intracellular stores. Interestingly, this release of erythropoietin comes from the kidney and the liver. This is in contrast to the ESAs, which are biological agents that stimulate erythropoietin by activation of the erythropoietin receptor. And remember, this is exogenous EPO production, so very different in terms of how they work. And in fact, HIF-PHIs are probably more physiological.
Good afternoon from me as well, and thanks very much for the introduction, Mario. So when they were first introduced, ESAs transformed treatment of anemia in patients with CKD by raising hemoglobin levels without the need for blood transfusions, which was the case up until that time. However, there are recognized limitations in the use of ESAs. For example, they have reduced responsiveness in patients with anemia of chronic kidney disease and underlying chronic inflammation. They are associated with an increased risk of cardiovascular events and there appears to be a dose-dependent effect with higher ESA doses associated with a higher risk of cardiovascular events. And finally, they have an unfavorable route of administrations, especially for patients who attend the outpatient clinics. They can only be administered either subcutaneously or intravenously, and this may be a barrier for some of our patients.
I think in addition to what Socrates has mentioned is that there's been a wealth of published data which shows that PIF-PHIs have been shown to be non-inferior to ESAs with regard to raising and maintaining the target hemoglobin levels in both non-dialysis-dependent and dialysis-dependent CKD patients. And compared to ESAs, patients treated with HIF-PHIs have a reduced need for iron supplementation. And this may be partly related to the fact that they seem to reduce hepcidin levels quite a lot more than with ESA therapy, and this results in a higher level of serum iron. Now, there have been quite a lot of phase 3 trials in both dialysis-dependent and non-dialysis-dependent patient population, and they have found comparable rates of adverse events when it comes to looking at all-cause mortality and cardiovascular events with HIF-PHIs and ESA therapies. And it's important to realize that this data shows that HIF-PHIs are as good as ESA therapy in terms of reaching a hemoglobin target and maintaining it, and in terms of adverse side effect profile.
Yes, moving a bit further with regards to the major adverse cardiac events with the HAFPH and ESAs, the majority of trials have demonstrated that both in dialysis-dependent and non-dialysis-dependent AHF-PHAs were non-inferior to ESAs. And this has been demonstrated very nicely in a Cochrane meta-analysis, including 51 studies of over 30,000 patients with non-dialysis-dependent and dialysis-dependent CKD, showing little or no difference between HAFPHIs and ESAs with regards to cardiovascular death, non-fatal MI, non-fatal stroke. I should mention here that there are some pooled analyses from individual trials, such the PROTECT trial of vadadustat in non-dialysis CKD patients, which showed a signal of high risk for MACE in the vadadustat group, which, however, was mostly driven by the higher hemoglobin targets in this group. To follow up and talk about the risk of cancer, this has also been found to be similar between HAFPHIs and ESAs. And again, a recent large meta-analysis of over 25,000 patients confirmed that the cancer risk was similar between the two agents. Another interesting point I'd like to mention here is that based on a meta-analysis of 8 randomized clinical trials, including patients of ESAs versus HAFPHIs, patients on the HAFs were more likely to withdraw due to adverse events compared to ESAs. However, and interestingly enough, in the placebo comparator trials, there was a similar incident of adverse events, with participants being more likely to withdraw in the placebo arms of the trials.
Thank you both for this analysis. I think that really we have efficacy and safety data, so we should move now with the discussion of the choice of the patient. So as first-line treatments, of anemia of CKD and treatment initiation. So my point now is that now that there is a choice between ESAs and HIF-PHIs, what is the recommended first-line treatment for a patient with anemia of CKD?
Both ERPP and UK Kidney Association guidelines very clearly indicate that iron therapy should continue to be the first consideration for patients with anemia of CKD. And iron deficiency can be classed as either absolute, defined as transferrin saturation of less than 20%, and ferritin levels either than 100 in non-dialysis-dependent patients and less than 200 in dialysis-dependent patients, or functional iron deficiency, which is defined as transferrin saturation of less than 20% with normal or even elevated ferritin levels. It is recommended that neither ESA nor HAFPHI therapy should be initiated in the presence of absolute or functional iron deficiency until iron deficiency is corrected and anemia persists. And at that point, we should differentiate between functional iron deficiency, which can often be addressed with iron supplementation, and anemia due to inflammation, which is more resistant to iron treatment.
Thanks, Socrates. Just want to add to that, for patients who are non-dialysis dependent or maintained on peritoneal dialysis, the choice between giving oral or parenteral iron really needs to take into account the severity of the iron deficiency, the potential side effects from oral iron and also potentially intravenous iron, and very importantly, the available of venous access because of the parenteral route, and of course, the potential requirements for future therapy with ESA therapy and PHI therapy. And as somebody who's been looking at iron therapy for many years, it's important to recognize we don't really know the best form of iron to give in the non-dialysis and in the peritoneal dialysis patients. Whereas in dialysis patients in general, it usually is that we use intravenous iron. So what I would say based on the UKKA guidelines is in general, we say a trial of oral iron remains the first-line treatment in non-dialysis-dependent patients, while intravenous iron is used for those who are intolerant of oral iron or remain with absolute or functional iron despite oral iron therapy. And reassuringly, both the European and the UK guidelines advise that the regime of high-dose intravenous iron, 600 milligrams in the first month and then 400 milligrams every month, used proactively in hemodialysis patients who have a ferritin of less than 700 and a T-sat of 40%. And that is based on, of course, on the large pivotal trial, which I was privileged to be part of, in which we demonstrated there was a 15% reduction in all-cause mortality and cardiovascular events using that regime.
Thank you very much for these comments, and we agree that we need to correct iron deficiency with either oral iron for PD and CKD non-dialysis patients or IV iron for hemodialysis patients, looking at, of course, at the ferritin levels. But after iron deficiency has been corrected, so what factors should be taken into consideration when choosing between ESAs and HIF-PHIs for treatment of CKD-related anemia? I would like to have your comments on this.
Thank you very much, Mario. This is a really important question because we're now in the era that we have an oral agent, which is the HIF-PH inhibitors, and we have the traditional ESAs that are only administered subcutaneously or intravenously. Both the RBP and UK Kidney Association guidance clearly indicate that treatment choice should be individualized and should be based on a number of considerations, including patient preference for oral treatment. This is something that we very frequently underestimate in clinical practice, and we should keep that in mind. Another consideration should be dialysis requirement. It may be easier for these patients to administer ESAs during the dialysis sessions. Challenges to administer ESAs, especially for frail older patients that cannot self-administer. And finally, the need for increased iron availability, ESA hyperresponsiveness or intolerance, which should dictate towards treatment with HAFPHI inhibitors. And the patient comorbidities should also be taken into account. But we will be working through some of these considerations in more detail and later in the podcast.
Yeah, thank you, Socrates. I agree with your comments that I would like now to have a point of Sunil about what hemoglobin level should treatment be initiated for anemia of CKD.
Thank you, Mario. Certainly, based on the UK guidelines, we recommend offering ESA treatment for patients with anemia of CKD who are likely to benefit from an improvement in physical function and quality of life and of course to avoid blood transfusions, which is the last resort to correct anemia. Although we didn't recommend a specific threshold, we do make the comment that the definition of anemia in CKD is a hemoglobin of less than 110 grams per liter. In the case of HIF-PHIs, our guidelines recommend initiating treatment after iron repletion, as we've mentioned previously, when the hemoglobin is below 105 grams per liter in either non-dialysis-dependent patients or dialysis-dependent patients with symptoms of anemia. And the reason why we chose that level was because that was the range used in all the clinical trials that were public. Just to go on further, the initial ESAR HIF-PHI dose really is based on multiple factors, including the hemoglobin level, the clinical circumstances, and that's really in line with the recommendations. We've actually made a specific comment that when you start HIF-PHI therapy, we recommend that a lower dose should be used in those patients who have been ESA naive compared to those who have previously received ESA therapy, because we are concerned about the risk of increasing hemoglobin too quickly in these patients. That's just a slight word of caution when starting these drugs.
Thank you very much. So as doctor, usually it's easier to decide when we want to start a treatment, but more difficult is to achieve and maintaining the target. So what are the current recommendations for achieving and maintaining target hemoglobin levels today?
Yeah, so in the non-dialysis CKD patients, the recommended target hemoglobin level with either HAF, PHIs, or ESAs is 10 to 12. And this has been shown in large landmark nephrology clinical trials, and we know that normalizing hemoglobin levels in patients with CKD can be detrimental with regards to cardiovascular outcomes. I should definitely emphasize here that it is very important to avoid rapid rises in hemoglobin. For example, a rise of over 2 grams per deciliter over 4 weeks, or very high hemoglobin levels of over 12, and we should stick with a target of 10 to 12 in non-dialysis CKD patients.
Just to add to that, in dialysis-dependent CKD patients receiving HIF-PHIs, in the UK guidelines have a similar target of 10 to 12 grams per liter, but in the rest of the world, most recommend a lower target of between 10 and 11 grams per liter. That's really depending on the choice of HIF-PHIs. And again, it's probably an individualized treatment regime you need to decide on depending on the patient in front of you.
Talking about monitoring, there's no real consensus in the community, and some common sense applies as well in the new agents. But as a general rule, based on both the UK Kidney Association and the ERBP guidelines, hemoglobin levels should be monitored between every 2 and 4 weeks, until the hemoglobin target range is achieved and stabilized. And then we can move to checking hemoglobin every 4 weeks thereafter, or as clinically indicated. Again, it is very important to emphasize that as with treatment, the monitoring of each individual patient should be based on his own hemoglobin target. So it should be individualized.
Okay, but how should the iron status be maintained during this treatment?
That's a really important question, Mario, because as we said at the very start, that neither of the drugs, ESAs or HIF-PHIs, should be started until the patient is iron replete. And it's important to make sure the patient remains iron replete during therapy with using either oral or intravenous iron therapy. Clearly, we may need to look in the future as to what is the definition of iron repletion with HIF-PHIs because of the fact they affect the absorption and mobilization of iron. And that's something for future research to look at.
Yeah, I agree. Very good. So let's just move to specific patient population and treatment consideration. We'd like to start the discussion on the route of the administration. So what is your point about the circumstances might a patient choose if PHI over ENISA?
Yes, again, a great question, Mario. Thank you very much for that. As mentioned before, patient choices are very important. At the same time, when we see patients in the clinic, they always ask from us to make or to dictate towards their decisions. According to the ERBP clinical practice document, patients with anemia of CKD who are not dialysis dependent or are dialyzing via the peritoneal dialysis or are on home hemodialysis treatment, they should be given the option to choose HAFPH inhibitors for treatment of their anemia if this is more convenient for them, and this is to avoid additional injections. So again, patient preference is very important. The same is the case for patients who are unable for various reasons to self-administer ESAs or patients who have needle phobia, and there's quite a big number of patients in the clinic we see with needle phobia. And in all of these groups of patients, HAFPHI inhibitors should be the preferred choice.
So, and just to add to the comments from Socrates, I think the other thing to remember, of course, because the drugs are oral compared to ESAs, which are injections, there's no requirement for refrigeration. And that's something which is becoming of increasing importance in the world. And that might also lead to an improvement in convenience for the patient to reduce cold storage requirements in pharmacies and in healthcare facilities and, of course, in the home. And we think about switching patients to oral therapies. This also potentially reduces the time and resource required by healthcare staff, either in the CKD patients or in the dialysis patients who have to prepare and administer the ESA inject. So that's something we need to think about when it comes to the stresses on the healthcare system and which are time limited.
Thank you. Thank you. So moving from the route of administration to another point, I think that we should discuss about the chronic inflammation. That inflammation in our patients is very common. So looking at the therapy, how do the therapeutic outcomes compare between the FPIHs and ESAs in patients with anemia of CKD and chronic inflammation? I would like to have your opinion about that.
Thank you, Mario. I think this is a really difficult area because we're really learning about this. We know that patients with chronic inflammation commonly to require higher doses of ESA therapy to maintain their hemoglobin targets, and that might lead to more adverse events. There are various studies, but I'm sure Socrates might comment on the various studies which have looked at this.
I would totally agree with Sunil. It's a really difficult topic with no definitive answer based on the clinical trial data. Study of both dialysis-dependent and non-dialysis-dependent patients with elevated CRP have indicated that higher doses of HAFPHIs were not required to achieve and maintain hemoglobin targets, and this was in contrast to ESAs, for which dose increases were often required. However, in all of the published trials, only patients with low-grade inflammation were included based on the CRP levels, and patients with chronic autoimmune disease or chronic inflammatory states who are more likely to have persistent inflammation were excluded from the studies. And as such, clinical judgment is required when determining the best choice of treatment for these patients. So I'd like to summarize by saying that although there is signal for an advantage in these states with HAFPHIs, more data are required, especially in the population of patients with a proper cross-inflammation.
Yeah, I'd agree totally with that, from Socrates. And that's why in the guidelines, both the UKA guidelines and the European guidelines have made the comment that they suggest, rather than recommend, that HIF-PHI treatment may be considered in people with underlying chronic inflammation, but as Socrates mentioned, further high-quality randomized trials are needed to really confirm this efficacy.
Thank you very much both for your comments. And Well, one more aspect is to go for other comorbidities. And unfortunately, our patients with CKD, they have many of these. So one point is, are either ESAs of HIF PHIs recommended for a patient with anemia of CKD and, for example, a history of cancer?
So that's a difficult question, Mario, to answer. There was a meta-analysis of phase 3 randomized trials which found no significant difference between ESAs and HIF-PHIs in the rate of cancer. Remember, you're comparing one drug with another. And, of course, in many of these trials, patients with a history of malignancy in the 5 years before enrollment in those trials didn't actually participate. And the other problem we have currently is with the data from the HIF-PHI trials, the follow-up is too short, only up to about 3 years. There is long-term data which will become available to look at the cancer risk. But certainly from the evidence, we haven't seen a cancer signal for HIF-PHIs at present. I'd be interested to hear from Socrates.
Thanks, Sunil. I would totally agree with you that more data required in this topic. At the same time, the current data suggests there's no real difference between ESAs and HIF-PHIs with regards to oncogenesis and potential for cancer. And that's why both in the ERBP and the UK guidance, we suggest that caution is recommended when using both agents in patients with a history of cured malignancy or those without cancer for at least 5 years. For people with active malignancy or malignancy within the past 5 years, we suggest that both agents should be avoided or used with extreme caution only if absolutely necessary. But again, having said that, I would go back to the individual assessment and evaluation of the benefit risk in each patient separately, as this may depend on the type of cancer, well, the patient comorbidities, severity of anemia, and finally, expected survival of the patient.
Thank you again. Just to define a little bit better, another group of patients with CKD is patients with cardiovascular disease, cardiovascular disorder, cardiovascular events. So what is the recommended treatment for patients with anemia or CKD with a history of cardiovascular events? Is there any data on this?
Thanks, Mario. Yes, there are data on cardiovascular risk in patients, and we all know that CKD patients have a higher risk of cardiovascular disease than the general population, and this is the most common cause of mortality in our CKD population. Additionally, an increased incidence of cardiovascular events has been observed with both ESAs and HIF-PH inhibitors treatment, and that may not be related directly to the agents, but it has been suggested that can be related to either rapid rises of hemoglobin, and that's why I've mentioned before we should be very cautious when we administer these agents, or large fluctuations in the hemoglobin level. And there is some suggestion that the ESAs itself are associated with higher cardiovascular risk when administered at very high doses. Evidence also suggests that higher hemoglobin targets are also associated with increased risk of mortality, hypertension, and stroke compared to targets of between 9 and 10, which is what we're looking to achieve in our patients.
And that's probably why, in terms of the UK guidelines, Socrates, that we've recommended caution when using ESAs in patients with a history of stroke and caution when using HIF-PHIs in patients with prior cardiovascular and also thrombotic events.
I would totally agree, Sunil, and that's why in the ARBP guideline, we also recommend to avoid HIF-PHIs or use them with extreme caution in patients with a cardiovascular or thrombotic event in the previous 3 months, and use with caution in patients with vascular access and a high risk of thrombotic complications. We should not forget, though, at that point, that untreated anemia can also be associated with increased cardiovascular events, and that should also be taken into account.
Absolutely, Surpreet. And certainly that's one thing we always should remember is that anemia is a strong association for cardiovascular mortality, all-cause mortality, and quality of life. But the other thing, as you've mentioned previously, just to remind people, is that to avoid this rapid rise in hemoglobin, because we think that that might be the reason why some of these events occur. So more than a 2 g/dL rise over 4 weeks, or very high hemoglobin levels, and we put a target of over 12 g/dL. The UK guidelines also suggest that lower dose regimes of HIF-PHI treatment should be considered in these patients.
Relevant to that point, Sunil, we have suggested in the ERBP guideline that in the case of hemoglobin overcorrection, which is not infrequent in clinical practice, we should consider treatment discontinuation for hemoglobin levels of over 13 g/dL and dose decreases for hemoglobin levels between 12 and 13 g/dL. I think this is also important to keep in mind.
Yes, very important, Socrates. And this is extremely common to have patients with CKD and cardiovascular disorder. These informations are quite important. I would like to move now in another direction, another group of patients that we follow that are the kidney transplant recipients. So my point is that if you have a patient with who was previously on dialysis and receiving ESAs or HIF-PHIs, but has recently received a kidney transplant, should their anemia treatment be changed? What is your point about this?
That's a really important group of patients, Mario, as myself being a transplant physician, and because we know that anemia actually is a strong risk factor for both poor outcomes in transplant patients, but also an increase in cardiovascular risk. And so we should not forget about correcting the anemia, first by, of course, correcting the iron deficiency. But for transplant patients, the UK guidelines have recommended that we basically follow the same guidelines as a non-dialysis patient, because really a transplant patient is a CKD patient. The problem is, of course, as yet the efficacy and safety of HIF-PHIs in kidney transplant patients has been poorly investigated. There really is insufficient information on the potential effects on the immune system and interactions with immunosuppressive drugs. But there are a few recent case series and independent studies which appear promising, showing an increase in hemoglobin and, as we mentioned previously, and a better iron utilization in patients with post-transplant anemia. And these drugs are well tolerated with no influence on the concomitant medication. So I think it's an area we need to look at more closely, but something certainly we shouldn't forget about.
Thank you, Sunil. This is very important also from your experience on kidney transplant patients. One more group of patients is the hospitalized patients. So my point is, how should treatment for anemia of CKD be managed if the patient becomes acutely ill or is hospitalized?
Yes, thank you. Yeah, thank you, Mario. It's a very common question, especially when our patients are admitted at other specialties. In the ERBP document, we have made no specific recommendations for hospitalized patients, but in the UK Kidney Associates guidelines, the recommendation is that ESA or HIF-PHI inhibitor therapy should be continued during acute illness, surgery, or hospitalization. They mention also that it should only be stopped if there is a clear contraindication, such as thrombosis, but for the majority of patients, this should be continued. And that makes sense because patients that are admitted in hospital with intercurrent illness, they usually tend to have a drop in the hemoglobin during the acute illness, so it makes sense to continue with these agents, otherwise their hemoglobin will drop further. Exploring a little more the thrombosis complications with HIF-PHI treatment, in the clinical trials, there was a signal for high risk of thrombotic events, mostly arteriovenous axis thrombosis, deep vein thrombosis, and pulmonary thromboembolism in some of the studies. There are other studies that have found similar or even fewer episodes of arteriovenous axis thrombosis associated with the use of HAFPIs. So I think that although we tend to avoid them in patients with a high thrombotic risk, there is still an area that needs more research and more data to come out and clarify what exactly is happening in these patients.
Thank you, Socrates. This is something important because we really have many patients with CKD with such a problem. So it's time now to make the summary of our discussion, and we discuss about all the implication of HAFPIs for clinical treatment of anemia CKD patients. So we have data in terms of efficacy in hemoglobin correction and maintenance, and these drugs are a viable alternative to the ESAs for iron replete patients with anemia CKD, and may also improve iron utilization. And we discuss this in our podcast. The other point is that HAFPIs may be effective in patients with underlying inflammation without the requirement for a dose increase. Although further data are needed to confirm this, we are looking for biomarkers of inflammation also, in which is the best biomarker of inflammation of CKD patients, which one should be used in looking at the anemia and CKD. So future studies are necessary. Then caution is recommended when prescribed both ESAs and HAFPIs to patients with a history of cardiovascular events. So this is extremely important because CKD patients have a high risk of cardiovascular disease. So we have this point of caution. It has not been possible to cover all the treatment consideration of anemia CKD during this podcast. So this is why we encourage the audience to review the complete guidelines for further details for both ERBP and UK guidelines. So with this, I really would like to thank my colleagues, Sunil and Socrates, for this very nice and important discussion. And so I would like also to ask you to say a few words to conclude our podcast.
Many thanks, Mario. Yeah, it's been a fantastic overview, and thank you also to you and Socrates. And hopefully those listening will learn much from this. And as you said, the guidelines are quite comprehensive and a good read for those who haven't seen them yet.
Thanks very much, Mario, as well. I also think this was a very nice overview. I'd like to conclude by saying that obviously there are a lot of unanswered questions, but at least we're in a great position in our era, having two different agents to treat anemia in our patients with CKD, and that has definitely transformed the management of anemia significantly.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much both again. And bye-bye, everybody.
You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS Journal Podcasts with your preferred podcast provider or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements and copyright information, please visit the article page on the journal website. The link to the article page can be found in the podcast description.